He told me yesterday that he thinks he probably has heard me speak 30 times, so that he's interested in hearing me this morning is indeed a miracle in itself. Good morning. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Mildred Frank. I'm from Toronto, from the Rocks Glen Traditional Group. My dry date is May the 18th, 1973, and I'm delighted to be here with you. Hi. Before I begin, I want to thank Bob. Where are you, Bob? Think of all the work that goes into this. And the beautiful organization, you know, everything has gone really smoothly, hasn't it? Bob, we appreciate you. We love you. Thanks. There's somebody else, I think, that needs to be thanked, and that's our good friend over there, Lee the taper, and Dave. Just think of all the work that it takes. I'm always amazed when they put everything out and they bring their machinery and they dedicate themselves to making tapes and CDs available. So let's give them a thanks. Now, do I look good? First things first. A couple of years ago, I chaired our conference in Toronto. And it's a big conference, so they put up the big screens. And since I was the chair, I was at the podium a number of times. And Sunday morning, when people were leaving, I was at the door saying goodbye and thanking them for coming. And one woman said, she said, "You are so photogenic." She said, "I just enjoyed seeing you on the screens." And then she kind of stepped back and she said, "You know, I think you look better on the screens than you do in real life." Okay, I'll settle down now. Couple of years ago, I was in the airport watching a father with his little boy. And what the father was doing, he was standing there by the window, and there was a plane being, they were loading things onto this plane. And this little guy, maybe he was two, maybe three, and the father wanted him to look outside and see what was happening. And the child either, well, he was obviously not interested in what the father was interested in. He had dropped a ball on the floor, and he was screaming for the ball. And what I watched was the father was gently, he would take it, you know, push, just, you know, nudge his face a little bit and say, "No, son, look there, look there." And I thought, you know, and the child simply was not capable. And finally, the father gave up, picked up the ball, and they walked away. And I thought, what a great metaphor for my experience of step two. My experience with God, because I'm not going to get into a whole deal of how you do it, but I am going to talk about how in my life I developed, or my relationship with God has taken root and set me on fire with life. And I wasn't always that way. You know, Bill says we come here, and he says we love but a few, we're indifferent to the many so long as they cause us no trouble, and we hate the rest. Well, that kind of describes me, but not quite. Because I hated everybody. I did not discriminate. And I think you could well describe me as a soul at war. I was at war with the world. I was at war with the people I had met. I was at war with myself. And I was certainly at war with that chief honcho. Is it that way today? No, this program is so powerful. The disease, the drinking of the alcohol, has forced me into, you know, it says, it's not an easy choice to make. Dying an alcoholic death or practicing some spiritual principles, Quite a choice, isn't it? But actually, alcohol beat me into a state of reasonableness. And so from that place, I have been able to be changed. I was going to say, I have been able to change. Yeah, I've changed the way I speak, I've changed the way I think, I've changed the way I've acted. But I think it was one of the old-timers, and I think he's here today, Bob from Arizona, who said to me one time, you don't change yourself, you do that work so you can be changed. And I think that's what's happened, because today I have to tell you, I like myself. I'm a decent person today. More surprisingly, I'm a happy person. And more surprisingly yet, I'm a loving person. You know, I really buy into what Carl Jung said when he said he believed that alcoholics were seeking the spirit with a capital S in every bottle of spirits. That's all I was ever looking for. And if you look through the big book, how can you interpret some of the things that are said there? If you believe some of the things, then I think, you know, it behooves me to take a look at things like, we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension. There's a statement. It says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It says, either God is nothing or God is everything. Make your choice. You see, it doesn't tell me how I have to understand God. And then on page 164, it says, see to it that your relationship with God is right and great things will come to pass. Of course, I'm an alcoholic, but Bill says, alcohol is the symptom. And I imply from that, it's not the problem. Sure, alcohol created problems for me, simply because it was such a great solution for what was really wrong with me. Chuck Chamberlain used to hammer this home to me day after day when he used to come out to Prince Albert when I was newly sober in 1966. And he'd say, your problem is you think you're separate from God. And at the time, I didn't understand that, but I do now. So, I come from a world, well, why did I have such difficulty in building a relationship with God? I come from a world where God was the fabric of existence. I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan, and in that area, I would say maybe 20 or 30 square miles, everybody that lived in there was Roman Catholic. They were farmers like we were, and they were Roman Catholic. You Prots wouldn't have done well in that area. On Sundays, everybody showed up at church. And this is the way we showed up. This is how we sat. To the left side of the altar sat the young women. Then there was an aisle, and then the married women. Then there was another aisle, and then the married men. And then there was another aisle, and way over there were the single fellas. And we kids, we sat at the front. And I can tell you, if anybody was missing, that was the subject of the dinner table conversation. Where are they and why aren't they in church? Belief in God was assumed. I went along with that. But I didn't understand original sin. What do you mean I've got a spot on my soul? What do you mean with all this doctrine and dogma? I tried to figure it out. And I couldn't. And then life intruded in my world. Life in the form of my sister Dora. You know, I talk about her all the time because she's very important in my life. I was a little kid when she's 3 years old. She was 16. Dora had been injured at birth. She couldn't study as fast as the other kids. And in those days, they called her retarded. And she cried at night and she crawled into bed with me. She'd say, Mildred, why was I ever born? Why didn't I die in the cradle? And I'd cry with her. And I couldn't fix it. You know, I practiced step one right there. I was powerless over that situation. But I had big brothers and sisters, and so I started the process of trying to get somebody to fix the outside world. Any of you ever done that? Really works well, doesn't it? When You see, we didn't talk about this in our family, so I didn't understand it. And when my brothers and sisters, who I thought loved me, didn't change the way my sister was, her crying, I figured they don't care about me, they don't care about her, and I went to God. I had heard the priest say that God was love and God was power. I never heard any of that business of, you know, God's going to punish you and so on. Maybe I heard it, but I didn't take it in. I had plans for God. This is the way you need to do the world. And it didn't happen. And I couldn't figure out, how can you have a God who can make beautiful trees, who can make sunsets, who can make the aurora borealis and the stars and all that, and who can't fix this sister of mine? And I became really confused. See, when you look at step two, I come to believe that there's a power bigger than me or us that can restore me to sanity. If you've got underlying beliefs like I had, you're going to have trouble understanding that. Because my experience of God is he's a useless twit. And so now I've got this problem. Don't worry, the sky isn't going to fall in. I've said it before and I haven't been struck dead, so... I don't say that out of irreverence to God. I say it out simply. That's the way I felt. I wanted somebody that was going to get things done, and that wasn't the way it was. And then at 5, I picked up a drink. There was always booze around. And that booze did for me what I had hoped God would do. I felt great when I drank. You know what I experienced? Was oneness. I loved you, you loved me, so I thought. Of course, it's all perception, because what the booze did, I believe, was shut down the voices of the false self, the voices of the ego. And so when those voices were quiet, I felt great. I could handle anything. And I have to tell you, for the next 35 years, I never thought sober again. You know, because alcohol worked. And I wanted to be in the bag all as much as I could be. It's not the right solution. And life has consequences. And when you use the wrong solution, because I don't think I'm here to falsely change. I think I'm here to grow in God consciousness. That's the only thing I can figure out. That, you know, I'm here to grow and change and make a difference and all that kind of thing, and I'm sure not going to do it hiding in a bottle of booze. But I didn't understand that. I continued to do church. And I put it that way because I can see now as I look back, I went because it was the thing to do. That's where my family went. And though I felt alienated from family, that's where I lived, so I did what they did. And then at 18, I made a strange decision. I don't fit at home. I'm not okay unless I drink. I've still got some ideas about God, that maybe God could be persuaded, and so I decided to go to a convent. Jeez. You know, I believe that all behavior is meaningful. We do it because there's a reason behind it. And my reason was, maybe. Maybe. Because I still believed that there was a God. I just didn't understand anything. And I thought, well, you know, maybe if I go to a convent, everybody that knew me laughed. They said, this isn't right for you. But I had made up my mind, so I went to the convent. I found a swinging convent in the United States. And it swang a little more after I was there, I can tell you. And I stayed there for 15 years. And, you know, I could write a whole book on that whole experience. But it was a good experience. I didn't leave after 15 years because I was disillusioned with the convent. I was disillusioned with life. It was just another way that life didn't work. I don't know how to make it work. The only place I can feel okay is when I drink, so I left. And I remember standing on the convent steps in January of 1966 thinking, I'm fixed now. I'm no longer Sister Mary Eugenia. I don't have the habit and all that stuff. Said goodbye to the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And I'm off to the secular world. And it wasn't everything it was cracked up to be. I didn't know how to live there. But I found out very quickly where I felt comfortable was at the bars. And at the bars, I found the booze and I found the men. And it wasn't very long before I was really doing some really bad stuff. Got thrown in jail, etc. Maybe that doesn't impress you, but it sure impresses you when you're 3 weeks out of a convent. Ten months of that kind of living, and I felt like the dirtiest piece of goods on the planet. I didn't know I was alcoholic. I knew I had to drink. And that, see, in the convent, I really pursued God. We did 6 hours of spiritual exercises every day. I mean, just think of what I'm saying. 6 hours of spiritual exercises every day, which shows me that you can acquiesce, you can comply on the outside, and nothing happens in here. And at the end of that time, I had myself signed into what was then known as the insane asylum. And I went there, and it was the insane asylum. And I was happy there. That's, you know. My brother found me there. My family hadn't heard from me for a year, and so they hired some private investigators, and they found me, and he took me back to the West, and he said, you want to go to Saskatoon, or you want to go to Regina? And for some reason, because my university was there, I said Saskatoon. What little did I know, I was to meet my destiny there. I was to meet the man I was to marry, a psychiatrist, wouldn't you know, and Dr. Hoffer, who sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if you understand my modus operandi, I am looking for somebody to fix my life. I can't fix it. I don't know that it has to be done by changing me. I think there is somebody out there who has some magic. Now, where was my life at this time? I'd been locked up 32 times in psych wards, mental institutions, insane asylums. I'd had 38 electric shock treatments. I had been tied to the bed, and it was not with one of you, trust me. I had been put in cold water baths because I used to get violent and I'd just get stiff and then they'd pull me out and so on. So Dr. Hoffer knew Bill Wilson and he said, this girl isn't all the things we said she is. She's an alcoholic and she should go to AA. And my doctor eventually agreed and I walked into AA in November of 1966 and I was happy because at last somebody was going to fix me. Goody, goody. My brother had gone to AA. My brother died 49 years sober. Isn't that wonderful? But at the time, my father called me after I had left for the convent, and he said, there's a miracle. There's a new organization has come to the prairies, and your brother isn't going to die. He said, he's an alcoholic. And this new organization, they call it AA, and he said, it's so good. Your brother is fine now. And he started to cry. And he said, your brother has been transformed. Ah, I like that word. Transformed is good. I didn't know what it implied, but I'm up for it. So I go to AA. And I sit there for 3 weeks, waiting for somebody to transform me. And after 3 weeks, you know, thank God that Bill put this in here, that alcohol is the symptom. So you take the alcohol away, you're still left with all the problems. And so I'm sitting there, I don't know how to do relationship. I've never been sober a day in my life if I could be drunk. I'm not saying I was stoned all the time or drunk, but I sure wanted to be. And now I don't have any medication, and I feel the way I feel, and I don't know what to do about it until I remember. I do know what to do about it. So I got medication, I medicated myself, and I sat in AA stoned for 5.5 years. If you're new, I do not recommend it. It was at that time, Wesley, you see, here again, I'm confronted with this. There's got to be somebody out there that's going to fix me. Chuck Chamberlain used to come to Prince Albert. Cease Cargill was there. Mac Cheater. Mac Cheater was an angel, and he used to sit down with me. Chuck used to sit down with me. He'd say, your problem is you think you're separate. I heard it with the ears. I didn't hear it with the ears of my soul. And I went my merry way, tearing a swath through that AA community for 5.5 years. Somehow or other, they don't care too much about this business if you're having affairs and all kinds of stuff. So at the end of that time, again, I'm the loser. I left AA, and I drank for 1.5 years. And everything that Ron said last night, you know, that it's progressive and it's fatal and all that, you know, I'm having DTs, I'm having convulsions. I've had 6 of those. And, you know, waking up in strange places with strange people who probably thought I was just as strange as I thought they were. And I wind up on a park bench. My husband, too, was alcoholic, and we both were drinking at this time, and we lost everything, and I mean everything. There was no little stash of money anywhere. There was nothing. And so I spent my last 3 weeks drinking on a park bench. I woke up in the psych ward, and there were 2 men sitting at the foot of my bed, and they really were there. And private detective, you know, my family, he had been hired to find me. The morning of the 20th, I decided what I was going to do. I was out of everything. I was D-O-N-E, done. There was nothing left. There was nobody left. I didn't have one idea about how I could fix this thing. I had nobody to call. You know, my family, thank goodness for them. They made no bones about it. You can come home, but you can't come home and act the way you've been acting. And so that's not an option. People said, stay away from us. We'll have you arrested if you come on our property. I was a nasty little piece of work. So I asked the nurse to get my clothes because I knew I was done. I'm going to take my life. Knew how to do it, and my mind was made up. She went to get my clothes, and at that moment I had a spirit. I can't call it anything else, because 1 minute I'm on my way out the door to kill myself, and the next minute something has reached into me and taken the compulsion and the obsession, and it's gone. And I know it's gone. I know I don't have to drink. And I remember saying, oh my, whatever this is, I don't know how to live sober, because I knew I did. The compulsion was gone. And I said, you'll have to send me somebody. And there was somebody rapped on the door. Honest to God, this happened. And he said, I saw you at breakfast, and he offered me some help. And 2 days later, he took me to a hospital treatment center, because there were no treatment centers in those days. And it was the perfect place. You have to understand, at this point, I hated just you say G-O-D, and I would spit you in the eye. And I didn't like AA much better. You were supposed to fix me. You were supposed to transform me, and you didn't do it. So this man took me to this institution, and they didn't push God, and they didn't push AA. You know, I think we get the perfect... I just believe today God is perfect, and God is everywhere, and God is active in our lives, and God was active in my life, and I got to be, even though I didn't recognize it, I got to the perfect place. And when they were done with me after 4 weeks, they gave me just, and I had no home. So they gave me enough money, and I got a room on Skid Row. They did not teach me about Skid Row in the convent. And my family hadn't taught me about Skid Row either. That was not part of the agenda. And so I remember opening the door, going, oh, my God, you know, I was to live there. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about that, because this is where I started to change. My soul was quiet. Before I left the institution, Dr. Maharaj, who was the chief psychiatrist there, he had taken an interest in me. He really cared about me. And I really, for some reason, connected. I think that's the first real connection I had ever made with a fellow human being. And he said to me, get a job. So I went to Skid Row, and then I went from door to door saying, please, have you got any work for me to do? And eventually some fellow had a factory, and he said, you can come and sweep the factory floor. And that's what I did. I swept the factory floor for 6 months. I had no television, no radio, no entertainment. Some days there was no food. I don't feel sorry for myself. It was a great experience. Once a week, I would hike myself to Donwood to spend an hour with Dr. Maharaj. And the softening process started. Love matters. And I'm sure other people loved me too, but for some reason, there was no judgment in him. He didn't want anything from me. We would just talk, and he would encourage me, and I would go back to my barren life on Skid Row, and it was okay because I had a higher power, and I knew I was going back next week. And that's where the change started in me. I lived that way for 6 months. And then one day somebody invited me to a meeting, and I didn't know we were going to an AA meeting. I might have refused. I don't know. Anyway, I went with them, and it was an AA meeting. And I think back to that meeting. I don't remember what was said. I'd had enough talk. What I saw was this. Remember, I said I started to change by that relationship with Dr. Maharaj. What I saw was people who were pleasant, who were kind to each other. They seemed to like each other. Now, why did I never notice that before? I don't know. But I did. And I found it attractive. Nobody was laying anything on me saying, you got to do this and you got to do that. And I found it attractive, and they kept saying, keep coming back, and I kept coming back. And then there were two angels at that meeting, two men, who took me aside and said, you have to do the steps. My first sponsor had gotten drunk, and they took me through the steps. You know, I was thinking about this. I've been thinking about this for a while to try and see, how did this whole coming to believe really happen to me? I didn't really believe in God at that time. I believed in Dr. Maharaj. I believed in the group that I was going to, in a way. I had some hope about that. And then I started to believe in these two men who came, and they read the book to me and told me what to do and saw me through the steps. And I don't remember what happened when we got to, step two, came to believe that there's a power that's going to restore you to sanity. I just know I did what I was told. And I have to tell you that I changed. I changed enough to be able to stay. I didn't pray a lot. Didn't know really how to pray. Who am I going to pray to? This God that I've been confronted with. Nothing seems to happen about the things you care about in life. Like, what are you supposed to go to that God for? What are you supposed to ask that God for? How are you supposed to relate to that God? Because it always seemed to me that the things I cared about just didn't fit in with that God's plans. Nothing seemed. You see, that's what was going on inside me, a hardness of heart. A lot of intellectual stuff, spending time reading books, taking courses at the university in theology and philosophy, trying to figure it out. That's where my head was. But I had been softened up. And once the softening up process starts, watch out. That pretty much went on for 20 years. I was a good member of AA. If you had said to me, what do you believe? I couldn't have had much to say to you about that. I had a sponsor who insisted that I keep doing the right things. Boy, that's wisdom. Because I know this, if you keep coming back and you keep doing the right things, it's a word here, it's a kindness there, something else happens. And bit by bit, one day you wake up and you're cracked wide open. And then everything happens, you see? And at 20 years, my life fell apart. I gave up my job, I gave up the last man, not the last man on earth, just the last man I'd associated with. And my life fell apart. I would know today what to do about that. I didn't then. And again, I thought, well, I guess maybe suicide isn't a bad idea. And I had another spiritual experience. And out of that, I knew it was going to be okay. I had no idea how. And Father O'Brien called me. About 3 weeks later, he was the rector at a Jesuit house. And he asked me to come and give a retreat. And I tell you that because something important happened at that retreat. It was a retreat for 70 or 80 women. And I'm okay with women by this time. I'm 20 years sober. And but not enough okay that I want to cry in front of women. And the very last conference I gave, I started to bawl. Not pretty like they do in the movies. I bawled. I'm sure I wasn't pretty. And I said to those women, I don't have a friend in the world. I've got lots of acquaintances, but no friends. Didn't even know that I really understood that. I felt for the first time like all my defenses were gone. I had no more unreality. I had built such a web around myself to protect myself. How in the world could I grow? I just remember feeling so vulnerable. And those women stepped forward one after the other, and I had to learn how to be real. And I understand today that if I'm going to grow in God consciousness, I can't do that based on a lie. I can't do that based on falseness. And so those walls coming down was a very important deal, really. The second important thing was I got to know Father O'Brien quite well. And I started to think about this relationship with God, and I'm giving retreats, and does what I'm saying match with what's going on in here? So I went to see Father O'Brien, and I said, Father, can you help me with this? He said, tell me how you got sober. Father O'Brien is not an alcoholic, but he's a very learned, wise Jesuit. He said, tell me how you got sober. And so I told him about May the 20th. And he said, did you hear what you just said? I said, yeah. He said, it doesn't seem to impress you very much. He said, how do you think that happened? See, the first 50 pages of our book are filled, aren't they, with expressions that indicate no human power can fix me. It says in the ABCs, I can't fix myself. No human power can fix me. It says there's no middle of the road solution. I'm strangely insane. It says I have strange mental blank spots. And on it goes. The main problem rests in the mind. Those old ideas I have that somebody out there is going to fix it. That's what I had been thinking all these years. He said to me, was there anybody in the room when this happened? When the compulsion was taken? I said, no. He said, had anybody phoned you that morning? I said, no. Was there anybody around? No. And as I said it, it was as if something shook me. It was like having another electroshock treatment. It struck me. He said, you have been touched by God. And that has made all the difference. That was when I really started to change. Isn't that what Bill is saying when he writes, we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension? What is the fourth dimension? It's the kingdom of heaven. This is where I'm supposed to live. But I can't live there while I'm living from the false self, while I'm living from that ego-driven mania that says, you have to be a certain way or I won't love you. You have to do it the way I want you to. I was so filled with, up to that, so filled with hatred and judgment and criticism. And if it is true that as the result of these steps we get a spiritual awakening, I got it that morning, and I've never lost it. And that to me is now where I go. I don't know who God is. Thank goodness we have in our book, God as you understand God. You know, because when Ebby went to see Bill, Bill says, my mind snapped shut when he thought, this guy has gotten religion. And if you had talked religion to me, my mind would have snapped shut, because I wanted no part of that God who did not seem to care about the things that I cared about. And this I could accept. It's not for the intellect. If my intellect could understand this, you'd have a different speaker. I don't get this. But I know something. And I think really that's what step two is inviting us to do. To become aware of the experiences of our lives. I believe today that God is right here. You know, that's the other statement in the big book. That either God is everything or nothing. And I think I was about 23 years when that one hit me. Well, if God is everything, then it's here. Whatever it is, I don't understand it, but I believe it's here. And I've observed something. When I take that seriously And when I live my life that way, when I say no to the voices of the false self that say you're not okay, nobody cares about you, and instead of going into anger and resistance and manipulation, saying, God, you love me. I believe that. I believe that you show up as me, and I'm going out into the world to live that way. When I do that, I can observe what happens. I can tell you, you know, today when I came in, there were my friends from Tennessee. There's Sandy and Bob from Arizona. There are my friends from, I can't even begin to mention you all. But I remember where I was. That old me that was shut down and said, no, it's got to go my way. I can tell you that first 6 months that I was sober in 1973, I walked the streets of Toronto and I felt like the damned. You know, there was no, I felt nobody sees me. Nobody knows me, and nobody cares. It's just another loser walking down the street. And I'd go into this factory, and I'd sweep and sweep and sweep, and nobody really made a fuss. That meant, you know, whatever. I'd go home, and that's how I lived. What a deal to come in, to be invited, to have people be happy to see you. See, I don't think that God refuses us anything. As I look over my life, I don't believe God ever was missing. God just has to wait, like that little boy. He couldn't see what his father wanted him to see. And I couldn't see what God wanted me to see. A whole business of living and suffering, if you will, and trying it my way, shows me what that got me. And so I can see now. I believe that all good is available. I don't think, you see, and that was the other thing. I used to think that life was about acquiring stuff, and I acquired a lot of stuff. And I thought it was about men, and I acquired a few of those too. And about sex, and about jewelry, and about houses, and about where you live and the car you drive and all those things. And all of it left me cold. It's an amazing thing. Don't get the idea that I'm saying, I've got wings. No wings. I can be a real whack job some days. Just get me on the right day. But I don't stay there. I don't stay there. I know what to do. You see, I think we can look at step two as part of the process of doing those 12 steps. So I'm in trouble with alcohol, I'm powerless over the booze, and I can't fix it. And if I've studied those first 50 pages, I know you can't fix it. And then I come to this. I got to come to believe that there's a power bigger than we are that's going to restore me to sanity. What does that mean? I think it means, I like the definition of sanity as seeing the big picture. You see, I don't see a very big picture when I look through my ego. Every once in a while, I look through a straw just to remind myself. And, you know, there's a whole room of stuff, and I'm looking through a straw. And if I think that's the reality, I'm going to make some really weird decisions. And by God, I do. You see, and I think then once I have... I don't know how it is with you. I just know that I was hard as a rock. But I was told to take actions I didn't believe in. Thank God for Clancy. And then those two men that took me through the steps. The one thing I've done right, I've continued to come. I have never been without a home group. I have never but been active in my home group. I've always sponsored people. I've always been sponsored. And like I said, I think bit by bit the change comes about. You know, if I think about that little boy with his dad, supposing that little boy decided at some time he was going to be an airplane engineer or he was going to be a pilot, a lot of stuff would have to happen, wouldn't it, so that little 2 or 3 year old could become a pilot. And I think for somebody like me to get rid of all those crusts and all those old ideas, it's taken a lot, and there's a lot to go. But, you know, I'm really very happy today because I do believe God is in my life, and that God makes it, and it makes a difference that God is here. And so there's nothing that I just look at it different. The other thing I appreciate is knowing that I'm not the boss and that I don't have a magic wand. Sometimes I would like to be in charge of you, selectively. But it's, you know, I know that that's not the way it is. I think another gift that has come to me is knowing that I'm not the only one on the planet. The universe does not revolve around me. You know, that's freedom. You may say, what the hell is she talking about? Well, I'm talking about the attitude that I used to have, like, why can't they see? Why can't they do it my way? It's the equivalent of saying, I'm in the middle of this thing. I think that every day I am asked to live the truth of step one. I am powerless. I am not God. God shows up as me, but I don't get to decide how things are. I think that's every day I can do that. And every day I can practice step two. Because if I keep the eyes of my soul open, every day I can grow in that understanding that God is here, God does care, and all is well. I want to thank you, Bob, again. And I want to thank every one of you for your kindness in being here with me, and God bless you all.